you wake in a strange room. Your clothes are foreign, and the walls are covered in objects from a different world. You don't know where or when you are, or if you're still dreaming. There are footsteps in the hall. Jumping up, you race out of the room and into the streets. You have just entered the Twilight Histories.
Hi, I'm Jordan Harbour. What you're about to hear is part two of a multi-part story called Ojibwe Miners. If you haven't heard part one, I'd recommend you go back and listen to that first. If this is your first time experiencing the Twilight Histories, our listeners have told us their favorite stories. So far are Mask of the Plague Doctor, Aztec Steel, and The Blood Ape. So those shows are a good place to start. If you're ready to start with today's show, this is Ojibwe Miners, Part 2, by myself, Jordan Harbour. A man is shaking you awake. You recognize him, but your memory is so hazy. One thing you know for sure is that you're freezing. You're lying in snow. It's a sooty, dark snow. You look at the sky behind the man. You have to blink the snow away as it falls into your eyes. The clouds are roiling and heavy, making the world dark. You aren't sure what time of day it is. "You're awake. Get up," the man says. His eyes are stony and gray, yet you can tell he's worried. He stands and trudges through the snow towards the other two bodies. You recognize Cass and Lianji, but this man, sure you've seen him before. You shake your head and rub your eyes, then rub your arms. It's freezing. You try to message your team, but your vision is blank. There are no screens. You try to run a system diagnostic. There's nothing. It's blank. You feel panic rising in your throat. You're unplugged. You feel the back of your head. You pop out the chip. It's thick, heavy, and steel gray. It's not your chip. You put it back in. You try everything you can, but there's no way to access it. There's no interface. Is it a dud? Wait, there's a folder. You can't see it. You can only sense it, like a tiny ghost. It's so faint. You sense a language translation tool and a tracker. You're being tracked? Why? You feel the phantom of a memory come back to you. Something to do with a wormhole? A different world. It's coming back to you fast. That man. What's his name? It was something strange. Organic memory is so unreliable. You wish you had your old chip. "Something's wrong with my arms," Lianji says. She sounds desperate. You leap up and trudge through the snow to her. She's sitting, flexing her arms, but they move in short bursts. "Why won't my arms work properly?"
"Me too,"
Cass says. He's trying to walk. His movements look strange and contorted. "It was the wormhole, wasn't it?" you say to the man. "You said there was no risk crossing through it, but clearly there was. It's corrupting their electronics." "The wormhole didn't do this." "Then what did?" "I don't know. Something in this world." "Are we even in the right world?" The man turns away so you can't see his face. You shake your head. You're angry. But you're not only angry at this fool. You're angry at yourself for trusting him. What's worse, you convinced your team to trust him. You led them into this danger. "I'm an idiot," you say. You don't get to decide that, the man says, turning to you sharply. I'll let you know when you're being an idiot, understood? You glare at him. Cast your eyes down, knight. I don't take well to insubordination. As long as you're here in this world, you're mine. I paid you. I paid you well. Now get your team and follow me. He starts walking through the snow. I'm so confused, Lianji says to you. Do you know what's going on? I think we're in the wrong world, you say. You come to the outskirts of a destroyed city. The buildings have mostly been reduced to rubble, and everything is scorched and black. You approach the walls of one of the more robust buildings and run your hand along its devastated surface. It seems to have been made of a mud-like concrete. Around the other side of the building, you find an ancient car. It's a green Jeep and has a white star on the side. There are bullet holes all over it. Inside, you see a couple bodies in hazmat suits, stained black with blood. What's this? Looks like something from the 20th century. American. But didn't you say the Ojibwe were the only civilization to rise in this world? Clearly, you've taken us to the wrong place. He doesn't answer. He approaches the car. He walks around it. He pulls out the bodies and looks inside, then walks around front and pops the hood. American Jeep, built in 1965, he says. He shakes his head. He looks troubled. He gives a deep sigh and puts his hands on his hips. Just doesn't make sense, you hear him say under his breath. We have to get out of the cold, Lianji says. What's wrong with my arms? Your wormhole's messing them up. I told you it wasn't the wormhole. You know what? This agreement is over. You broke your end of the deal, so we're done. Isn't risk part of your job? I know the risks ahead of time. You didn't say we'd end up in the wrong world. You assured us the wormhole wouldn't damage us. Actually, I told you there was a risk that you'd end up in the wrong world. And the wormhole didn't damage your arms. That never happens. So, I guess we're the first. Great. You can keep your money and keep your ridiculous dreams of conquest. Just get us out of here. You're still stuck here for a month. Get us back. I can't. It's programmed from the other side. Well, how are you going to fix that? It's not broken. That's just how it works. So you're saying you sent us to the wrong world and you can't get us back? No, I'm saying we can't go back for 1 month. We have to wait for the tunnel to open again. There's a blinding flash of light. You raise your hands over your eyes, but you still see the man and Lianji's bodies in X-ray. You can see all their bones. You turn to run and smack into Cass.
I can't move,
he says. You hear a massive sonic boom from the explosion. A shockwave rips through the rubble, flipping over the Jeep. You grab onto Cass, and the two of you are thrown through a building and land on the far street. You're hurt, but thankfully you landed on top of Cass and not the other way around.
I can't move.
Okay, I have to find the others. You run through the hole that you and Cass made in the wall of the building. Your foot falls through a crack in the floor. You pull yourself out and keep running. You find the man and Lianji lying dazed in the street. A huge dust cloud is rolling towards you. A mushroom cloud is forming above it. Come on, you say. They pull themselves up and follow you into the rubbled building. You find the place where your foot fell through and rip up the floorboard. The Kachi and the man jump down. You look over to Cass. You can see him through the hole in the building. He's managed to rise into a kneeling position, his Gatling gun pointed towards the mushroom cloud as though he were about to duel with the bomb. The gun roars to life and bullet casings fly from him. His face is an expression of resolve. The cloud hits you and you're thrown down the hole. It's immensely hot. The man desperately pushes some planks over the hole and tries to patch it. There's a great crash above, and you fall to the ground in a cloud of dust. You're sure the remains of the building have collapsed, trapping you in the cellar, or whatever it is. It's pitch black. Lanji, where are you? You say.
I'm here.
Are you okay?
My arms aren't working, she says. That damn wormhole.
I told you it wasn't the wormhole, the man says.
It's nuclear fallout messing with your electronics.
You're giving me an I told you so in the middle of a nuclear war.
You're really out to lunch, aren't you?
You seem to need help understanding the mess you're in.
I'm going to kill you.
How? You going to kick me to death?
Guys, chill out, okay? You say. Cass is still up there.
He'll be dead by now.
How do you know?
The man turns on his flashlight and shines it at Lianji. Can't you feel the temperature rising? That's not from her flushed face. The world is on fire up there. A nuclear fire. And we're under 20 feet of rubble. That's the only thing protecting us. By now, your rook is a pile of melted titanium and fake plastic flesh. Lianji closes her eyes and puts her chin to her chest. You know how this must hurt her. She takes great pride in never having lost a team member. She's very close to Cass. You also know this sadness will not last. When she comes around, she will blame the client for Cass's death. And then she will kill him. You've never seen her kick a man to death before, and you're beginning to feel curious how that would look. The client pops the flashlight into lantern mode, and the room fills with a dull light. You look around. You're in a cellar or basement. It's an earthen room with a rocky floor, wet from melted snow that's dripping down from the broken ceiling. The room has a musty smell to it that makes your nose burn. There are a few ceramic crates in the corner with strange celestial patterns on their sides, stars and planets. You open them, but they're empty except for moldy rags. On one of the walls, you find the shape of an ellipse cut into the rock face. You peer inside the cut rock, but it's only about an inch deep. You stick the point of your knife in. You twist it down. The rock beneath moves, as though it were on some kind of track.
What is it? The client says.
I don't know. You press your shoulder against it, but it doesn't budge.
Think it might be art?
The man approaches and runs his finger along part of the design, then shrugs and sits in the corner.
Art,
he says, almost spitting the word.
What did you say your name was again?
You say to the client.
Yamoira,
he says. He crosses his arms. You take the flashlight from him and do a careful inspection of the room, checking every crevice. On the far wall, you find what looks like a script carved into the stone. Your chip translates the strange symbols into numbers. The first row says 230. Below it is the number 20. Under that is a small ellipse, similar to the larger one on the far wall. The numbers are vaguely familiar. You wish you had your old chip.
It would be so easy to just run these numbers through an analyzer. Hey, you, Moira, you say. You know something about these people. Do you know what these numbers mean? What numbers? 230 and 20. Not a clue. How about you, Lianji? She doesn't even answer. She's still staring at the floor, rage in her eyes. Well, we'd better start digging, you say. There's no point. The radiation up there will kill us, if not the heat. Better to just stay down here and die. You stick your knife into the ceiling, and rubble runs down. Useless, the Moira says. You probably have about 20 feet of rubble to get through. The entire building fell on top of us, and even if we had Cass to dig, there would be nowhere to put the rubble that needs to be moved. Just sit down. We're dead. You try to swallow your panic, but you can feel your heart beating faster. You close your eyes and practice the breathing technique your mother taught you as a child. An anxious mind is chaos. A calm mind is clarity. Clarity solves all problems. You must remain calm. Focus on your breathing. Your shaking hand rises to one of the grenades on your chest strap. You have enough firepower to blow all this rubble off. But of course, you'd be incinerated too. At some point, that might be how it ends. It would be a suitable death for you, considering how many lives you've ended this way. You've lost count of how many people you've killed. None of it matters anyways. Everyone is bound to die eventually. That is the cycle of life. You think back to the story your mother used to tell you in India. The story about a mythical war. Arjun had to fight his own family in a battle. He was sad, but then the god Krishna came to him and said that death didn't matter. Everyone who died would simply be reborn again. Death follows life. Life follows death. The cycle goes on and on. So go forth, kill, gain glory, and don't worry about death. You've held that story for so long. It's been the one comfort of your soul. If Arjun could kill his own family in battle, then surely you could kill an apartment block filled with families. And Arjun was no psychopath. It hurt him to kill. He cried. You also cried. But that is how the universe works. It is a constant turning of life and death, cycle after cycle, as the galaxy spins out into the vast void of space. The spin of the galaxy. How many years does that take? Isn't it a big number? A number like 230 million years to go around once? Nah, couldn't be. But it is something like that. You're sure you've heard a number similar to 230 million when you were young. The movement of the stars was an important part of your mother's stories, but you don't remember the number she told you. They were stored in your chip, not in your organic memory. Or were they? Can you remember? 230. 20. You walk over to the large ellipse carved into the wall. An ellipse? Well, it's not so strange, is it? An ellipse is the shape of the galaxy, after all, at least if you view it from the side. The ceramic pots have images of stars and planets, so there is that link. You run your fingers along the ellipse for one full cycle. You notice it has little indents all around it, with longer ones at intervals of 20. You do a quick count, and you do indeed come up with the number 230. One galactic year, 230 million Earth years, you say under your breath. Is that what these numbers are? Each mark representing a million years? What a fascinating people. What are you mumbling? Moira says. 20? What are you? Why 20? What are you going on about? Moira, I think this is our galaxy. The first number is the clue. It takes the galaxy 230 million years to cycle through once. At least, I think it does. But I don't know what the second number means. So what? Let me put it to you this way,
I plan to blow us up. You pull out one of your grenades and show it to Yamoira. It's hard to die when things are not complete. If we can solve this riddle, then everything is in place and we will be finished. It will be tidy. There will be nothing left for us except death. Then I can end our lives. Why do we have to wait for you to figure out a riddle? Just do it now. Because as long as there's something left to do, we should do it. Give me the grenade, knight. I'll do it. No, you say. Yamoira rises to his full height and stares down at you. His dark skin and high cheekbones make him look like a warrior from some ancient time. But you've killed warriors before. 20. What does that number mean? Yamoira's eyes shrink into slits. You see his hands clench, his muscles tighten, ready for battle. Is it a distance in space? Yamoira's eyes dart down to your grenade. Is it a length of time? Yamoira crouches down, ready to pounce. It's the age of the sun, the Angie says. You both turn to her. What do you mean? You say. I don't know. It's just a guess. But how did you come up with that? Just seems about the right age of the sun. 20? No. That's just how many times the galaxy has turned since the sun was born. At least it could be. Sorry, I don't follow. 230 million times 20. That's about 5 billion years, right? You do some quick mental calculations. Yes, 230 million times 20 is 4.6 billion. Well, how old is our sun? About 4 or 5 billion years. You know what? You might be right. How did you figure that out? She shrugs and raises her eyes to you. Her rage has been tamed by a flash of deep intelligence. The kind of intelligence that's ensured you've survived many missions that would have seemed impossible without her brilliant leadership. Her ability to control her emotions and reason under immense pressure. Okay, so let's assume we have a new number, 4.6. But now, what do we do with that? What do they want us to do with that? Yamoira leaps at your arms and grabs your grenade. The lantern falls to the ground and clamps shut, leaving you in darkness. You feel a rush of air, then you hear bone cracking. Yamoira grunts in pain. You'll have to turn the lantern back on. My arms don't work, Lianji says to you. You pat the ground until you find the lantern, then turn it on. Yamoira is crumpled on the ground, his hands over his face. You see blood dripping through his fingers. Lianji smiles at you. Okay, let's figure this out, she says. You take out your knife and jam it into the crack in the ellipse, right at the bottom over the longest dash. The point hits solid and stops. Keeping the pressure on, you pull the knife around the ellipse. Your knife point moves and the rock beneath grinds along its track. Tiny clinks mark its progress. You look back at Lianji. Her eyes are raised in surprise. Keep going, she says. You move your knife around the entire ellipse until you're back where you started. There's a clanking sound behind the wall as its gears are activated. That's 230. It won't go anymore. Now what? Try going back the other way, 20 clicks, she says. You move your knife very slowly, counting 20 clicks. Again, when you hit that number, you hear a clanking sound deep in the rock. Now 4.6 the other way. You move your knife 4 clicks. Here we go, you say. You budge your knife very slightly, and a clanking, grinding sound resonates from behind the wall. The whole thing moves inward as though on a great hinge to reveal a dark circular tunnel going down. Cold air blasts you in the face. You switch the lantern back to flashlight and shine it into the darkness. The tunnel leads deep into the earth beyond the reach of the light. Go on, Lianji says, her eyes alight with excitement. She turns and kicks Yamoira in the ribs.
Get up, you fool, she says. That was Ojibwe Miners, Part 2, by myself, Jordan Harbor. Patreon is how we support this show. Without our valued patrons, I honestly don't think we'd have been able to sustain the Twilight Histories for over a decade as we have. There have been ebbs and flows, high times when we were on fire, like when Apple recognized us as their best of 2019, and low times, when I started having kids back in 2012 and was simply exhausted. Right now, I feel like we're revving up for a high time. Our patrons gave us clear direction on the kinds of shows they like, and our team has mobilized to deliver the best we can. And always, it's our Patreon community that's played that crucial role over the years in giving us focus. I think of our patrons all the time, about what they would like, how we can improve for them, and there are many names in our community I've grown familiar with. If you want to be one of those truly valued patrons and become part of our story, please join us. Visit the website at twilighthistories.com and follow the link to our Patreon page. I'm Jordan Harbor. Thanks for listening to the Twilight Histories. Until next time, take care.